off. Dr. Wataya would really give it to me if I started acting like that. The other person can be a rock or a wall, but I'll find that one tiny point of compromise. That's our job, finding that point of compromise. If they won't sell you the refrigerator, make them sell you some ice. So I racked my brains trying to find some way to pull this off. Let me tell you, that's what makes us human, coming up with a million different ideas. So all of a sudden, a good one popped up in my foggy brain like a star showing through a break in the clouds. That's it, I told myself. Why not have a conversation on computer screens? You know, put words on a screen with a keyboard. You can do that, can't you, Mr. Okada?
I had used a computer when I worked in the law firm, researching precedents, looking up personal data for clients, and communicating via email. Kumiko had also used computers at work. The health food magazine she was an editor on had computer files on recipes and nutritional analyses.
It wouldn't work on just any old computer,
continued Ushikawa.
But with our machine and yours, you ought to be able to communicate at a pretty fast pace. Ms. Kumiko says she's willing to talk with you that way. It was as much as I could get her to agree to. Exchanging messages in real time, it would almost be like talking to each other. That's the one last point of compromise I could come up with. Squeezing wisdom out of a monkey, what do you say? You may not be too crazy about the idea, but I put my brains on the rack for that one. Let me tell you, it's tiring work thinking that hard with brains you don't even have.
I shifted the receiver to my left hand.
Hello, Mr. Okada? Are you listening?
I'm listening, I said.
All right, then. The one thing I need from you is a password to access your computer. Then I can set up a conversation between you and Miss Kumiko. What do you say?
I'd say there are some practical problems standing in the way.
Oh, and what might those be?
Well, first of all, how can I be sure the other person is Kumiko? When you're talking on the computer screen, you can't see other people's faces or hear their voices. Someone else could be sitting at the keyboard pretending to be Kumiko.
I see what you mean,
said Ushikawa, sounding impressed.
I never thought of that, but I'm sure there must be some way around it. Not to flatter you, but it's good to view things with skepticism, to have your doubts. I doubt, therefore I am. All right, then. How about this? You start out by asking a question that only Miss Kumiko would know the answer to. If the other person comes up with the answer, it must be Kumiko. I mean, you lived together as man and wife for several years. There must be a few things that only the two of you would know.
What Ushikawa was saying made sense. That would probably work, I said. But I don't know the password. I've never touched that machine. Nutmeg had told me that Cinnamon had customized every inch of the computer's system. He had compiled his own complex database and protected it from outside access with a secret code and other ingenious devices. Fingers on the keyboard, Cinnamon was absolute ruler over this three-dimensional subterranean labyrinth. He knew every one of its intertwining passages and could leap from one to another with the stroke of a key. For an uninformed invader, which is to say anyone but Cinnamon, to grope his way through the labyrinth, past the alarms and traps, to where important data lay, would have taken months, according to Nutmeg. Not that the computer installed in the residence was especially big, it was the same class of machine as the one in the Akasaka office. Both were hardwired to the mainframe they had at home, though. There, Cinnamon, no doubt, stored their client data and did their complex double bookkeeping. But I imagined that he kept something more in there than the secrets connected with the work that he and Nutmeg had done over the years. What led me to believe this was the depth of the commitment to his machine that Cinnamon displayed on occasion when he was in our special residence. He normally stayed shut up in the small office he had there, but every now and then he would leave the door ajar, and I was able to observe him at work, not without a certain guilty sense of invading someone's privacy. He and his computer seemed to be moving together in an almost erotic union. After a burst of strokes on the keyboard, he would gaze at the screen, his mouth twisted in apparent dissatisfaction or curled with the suggestion of a smile. Sometimes he seemed deep in thought as he touched one key, then another, and sometimes he ran his fingers over the keys with all the energy of a pianist playing a Liszt etude. As he engaged in silent conversation with his machine, he seemed to be peering through the screen of his monitor into another world with which he shared a special intimacy. I couldn't help but feel that reality resided for him not so much in the earthly world, but in his subterranean labyrinth. Perhaps in that world Cinnamon had a clear, ringing voice with which he spoke eloquently and laughed and cried aloud. "Can't I access your computer from the one here?" I asked Ushikawa. "Then you wouldn't need a password."
"No, that wouldn't work. Your transmissions might reach here, but transmissions from here wouldn't reach there. The problem is the password, the open sesame. Without that, there's nothing we can do. The door won't open for the wolf, no matter how hard he tries to disguise his voice. He can knock and say, 'Hi, it's me, your friend Rabbit,' but if he hasn't got the password, he gets turned away at the door. We're talking about an Iron Maiden here."
Ushikawa struck a match at his end and lit a cigarette. I pictured his snaggled yellow teeth and drooping mouth.
"It's a 3-character alphanumeric password. You have 10 seconds to input it after the prompt shows. Get it wrong 3 times and access is denied, plus the alarm goes off. Not that there are any sirens that ring or anything, but the wolf leaves his footprints, so you know he was there. Clever, huh? If you calculate all possible permutations and combinations of 26 letters and 10 numbers, it's practically infinite. You just have to know the password, or there's nothing you can do."
I thought this over for a time without replying.
"Any ideas, Mr. Okada?"
After the client was driven away in the back seat of the Mercedes the following afternoon, I walked into Cinnamon's small office, sat down in front of his computer, and flipped the switch. The cool blue light of the monitor came on with a simple message: "Enter password within 10 seconds." I input the 3-letter word that I had prepared: "Zoo." The computer beeped once and displayed an error message: "Incorrect password. Enter password within 10 seconds." The 10 seconds started counting down on the screen. I changed to uppercase and input the same letters: "Zoo." Again, I was refused access. "Incorrect password. Enter correct password within 10 seconds. If incorrect password is input once more, access will automatically be denied." Again, the 10 seconds began counting down on the screen. This time, I made only the Z uppercase. It was my last chance. "Zoo." Instead of an error message, a menu screen opened with the instruction, "Choose one of the following programs." I released a long, slow breath, then began scrolling through the long list of programs until I came to communications software. Highlighting this, I clicked the mouse. "Choose one of the following programs." I chose chat mode and clicked the mouse. "Enter password within 10 seconds. This was an important junction for Cinnamon to lock out access to his computer, and if the junction was important, the password itself ought to be important. I typed in sub. The screen read, "Incorrect password. Input correct password within 10 seconds. The countdown began. 10, 9, 8. I tried the combination of upper and lowercase letters that had worked the first time. Sub. A prompt flashed on the screen. Input telephone number. I folded my arms and let my eyes take in this new message. Not bad. I had succeeded in opening two doors in Cinnamon's labyrinth. No, not bad at all. Zoo and Sub would do it. I clicked on Exit and returned to the main menu, then chose Shutdown, which brought up the following options. Record procedures in operations file, yes or no. As instructed by Ushikawa, I chose no to avoid leaving a record of the procedures I had just executed. The screen quietly died. I wiped the sweat from my forehead. After checking to be certain that I had left the keyboard and mouse exactly as I had found them, I moved away from the now cold monitor. 20. Nutmeg Story. Nutmeg Akasaka took several months to tell me the story of her life. It was a long, long story with many detours, so that what I am recording here is a very simplified, though not necessarily short, summary of the whole. I cannot claim with confidence that it contains the essence of her story, but it should at least convey the outline of important events that occurred at crucial points in her life. Nutmeg and her mother escaped from Manchuria to Japan, their only valuables the jewelry they were able to wear on their bodies. They traveled up from the port of Sasebo to Yokohama to stay with the mother's family, which had long owned an import-export business dealing primarily with Taiwan. Prosperous before the war, they had lost most of their business when Japan lost Taiwan. The father died of heart disease, and the family's second son, who had been second in command, was killed in an air raid just before the war ended. The eldest son left his teaching post to carry on the family business, but his temperament did not suit a life of commerce, and he was unable to recoup the family fortunes. They still had their comfortable house and land, but it was not a pleasant place for Nutmeg and her mother to live as extra mouths to feed during those straitened post-war years. They were always at pains to keep their presence as unobtrusive as possible, taking less than the others at mealtimes, waking earlier than the others each morning, taking on a greater share of the household chores. Every piece of clothing the young Nutmeg wore was a hand-me-down from her older cousins, gloves, socks, even underwear. For pencils, she collected the others' cast-off stubs. Just waking up in the morning was painful to her. The thought that a new day was starting was enough to make her chest hurt. She wanted to get out of this house, to live alone with her mother somewhere where they didn't always have to feel constrained, even if it meant living in poverty. But her mother never tried to leave. "My mother had always been an active person," said Nutmeg, "but after we escaped from Manchuria she was like an empty shell. It was as if the very strength to go on living had evaporated from inside her." She could no longer rouse herself to anything. All she could do was tell Nutmeg over and over about the happy times they used to have. This left Nutmeg to find for herself the resources to go on living. Nutmeg did not dislike studying as such, but she had almost no interest in the courses they offered in high school. She couldn't believe that it would do her any good to stuff her head full of historical dates or the rules of English grammar or geometric formulas. What she wanted more than anything was to learn a useful skill and make herself independent as soon as possible. Her concerns were quite different from her classmates' comfortable enjoyment of school life. The only thing she cared about was fashion. Her mind was filled with thoughts of clothing from morning to night. Not that she had the wherewithal to dress in style, she could only read and reread the fashion magazines she managed to find, and to fill notebooks with drawings of dresses in imitation of those she found in the magazines, or clothes she had dreamed up herself. She had no idea what it was about the fancy dresses that so captivated her. Perhaps, she said, it came from her habit of always playing with the huge wardrobe that her mother had in Manchuria. Her mother was a genuine clothes horse. She had had more kimonos and dresses than room in their chests to store them, and the young Nutmeg would always pull them out and touch them whenever she had a chance. Most of those dresses and kimonos had to remain in Manchuria when the two of them left, and whatever they were able to stuff into rucksacks, they had to exchange along the way for food. Her mother would spread out the next dress to be traded, and sigh over it before letting it go.
Designing clothes was my secret door to a different world, said Nutmeg. A world that belonged only to me. In that world, imagination was everything. The better you were able to imagine what you wanted to imagine, the farther you could flee from reality. And what I really liked about it was that it was free. It didn't cost a thing. It was wonderful. But imagining beautiful clothes in my mind and transferring the images to paper was not just a way for me to leave reality behind and steep myself in dreams. I needed to go on living. It was as natural and obvious to me as breathing. So I assumed that everyone else was doing it too. When I realized that everyone else was not doing it, that they couldn't do it even if they tried, I told myself, I'm different from other people, so the life I lead will have to be different from theirs.
Nutmeg left secondary school and transferred to a school of dressmaking. To raise the money for her tuition, she begged her mother to sell one of her last remaining pieces of jewelry. With that, she was able to study sewing and cutting and designing and other such useful skills for 2 years. When she graduated, she took an apartment and started living alone. She put herself through a professional fashion design school by waitressing in restaurants and taking odd jobs, sewing and knitting. And when she had graduated from this school, she went to work for a manufacturer of quality ladies' garments, where she succeeded in getting herself assigned to the design department. There was no question but that she had an original talent. Not only could she draw well, but her ideas and her point of view were different from those of other people. She had a clear image of precisely what she wanted to make, and it was not something she had borrowed from anyone else. It was always her own, and it always came out of her quite naturally. She pursued the tiny details of her image with all the intensity of a salmon swimming upstream through a great river to its source. She had no time for sleep. She loved her work and dreamed only of the day she could become an independent designer. She never thought about having fun outside of work. In fact, she didn't know how to do any of the things people did to have fun. Before long, her bosses came to recognize the quality of her work and took an interest in her extravagant, free-flowing lines. Her years of apprenticeship thus came to an end, and she was given a free hand as the head of her own small section, the most unusual promotion. Nutmeg went on to compile a magnificent record of accomplishment year after year. Her talent and energy attracted the interest of people not only within the company, but throughout the industry. The world of fashion design was a closed world, but at the same time it was a fair one, a society ruled by competition. A designer's power was determined by one thing alone: the number of advance orders that came in for the clothing that he or she had designed. There was never any doubt about who had won and who had lost. The figures told the whole story. Nutmeg never felt that she was competing with anyone, but her record could not be denied. She worked with total dedication until her late 20s. She met many people through her work, and several men showed an interest in her, but their relationships proved short and shallow. Nutmeg could never take a deep interest in living human beings. Her mind was filled with images of clothing, and a man's designs had a far more visceral impact on her than the man himself ever could. When she turned 27, though, Nutmeg was introduced to a strange-looking man at an industry New Year's party. The man's features were regular enough, but his hair was a wild mass, and his nose and chin had the hard sharpness of stone tools. He looked more like some phony preacher than a designer of women's clothing. He was a year younger than Nutmeg, as thin as a wire, and had eyes of bottomless depth from which he looked at people with an aggressive stare that seemed deliberately designed to make them feel uncomfortable. In his eyes, though, Nutmeg was able to see her own reflection. At the time, he was an unknown but up-and-coming designer, and the two were meeting for the first time. She had, of course, heard people talking about him. He had a unique talent, they said, but he was arrogant and egotistical and argumentative, liked by almost no one.
"We were two of a kind," she said, "both born on the continent. He had also been repatriated after the war, in his case from Korea, stripped of possessions. His father had been a professional soldier, and they experienced serious poverty in the post-war years. His mother had died of typhus when he was very small, and I suppose that's what led to his strong interest in women's clothing. He did have talent, but he had no idea how to deal with people. Here he was, a designer of women's clothing, but when he came into a woman's presence, he would blush and behave crazily. In other words, we were both strays who had become separated from the herd.
They married the following year, 1963, and the child they gave birth to in the spring of the year after that, the year of the Tokyo Olympics, was Cinnamon. His name was Cinnamon, wasn't it?
No sooner was Cinnamon born than Nutmeg brought her mother into the house to take care of him. She herself had to work non-stop from morning till night and had no time to care for infants. Thus, Cinnamon was more or less raised by his grandmother. It was never clear to Nutmeg whether she had ever truly loved her husband as a man. She lacked any criterion by which to make such a judgment, and this was true for her husband also. What had brought them together was the power of a chance meeting and their shared passion for fashion design. Still, their first 10 years together were fruitful for both. As soon as they were married, they left their respective companies and set up their own independent design studio in an apartment in a small west-facing building just behind Aoyama Avenue. Poorly ventilated and lacking air conditioning, the place was so hot in summer that the sweat would make their pencils slip from their grasps. The business did not go smoothly at first. Nutmeg and her husband both had an almost shocking lack of practical business sense, as a result of which they were easily duped by unscrupulous members of the industry, or they would fail to secure orders because they were ignorant of standard practice or would make obvious, simple mistakes. Their debts mounted to become so great that at one point it seemed the only solution would be to abscond. The breakthrough came when Nutmeg happened to meet a capable business manager who recognized their talent and could serve them with integrity. From that point on, the company developed so well that all their previous troubles began to seem like a bad dream. Their sales doubled each year until, by 1970, the little company they had started on a shoestring had become a miraculous success, so much so that it surprised even the arrogant, aloof young couple who had started it. They took on more staff, moved to a big building on the avenue, and opened their own shops in such fashionable neighborhoods as the Ginza, Aoyama, and Shinjuku. Their original line of designer clothes often figured in the mass media and became widely known. Once the company had reached a certain size, the way they divided work between themselves began to change. While designing and manufacturing clothes might be a creative process, it was also, unlike sculpting or novel writing, a business upon which the fortunes of many people depended. One could not simply stay at home and create whatever one liked. Someone would have to go out and present the company's face to the world. This need increased as the size of the company's transactions continued to grow. One of them would have to appear at parties and fashion shows to give little speeches and hobnob with the guests and to be interviewed by the media. Nutmeg had no intention of taking on that role, and so her husband became the one to step forward. Just as poor at socializing as she was, he found the whole thing excruciating at first. He was unable to speak well in front of a lot of strangers and would come home from each such event exhausted. After 6 months of this, however, he noticed that he was finding it less painful. He was still not much of a speaker, but people did not react to his brusque and awkward manner the way they had when he was young. Now they seemed to be drawn to him. They took his curt style, which derived from his naturally introverted personality, as evidence not of arrogant aloofness, but rather of a charming artistic temperament. He actually began to enjoy this new position in which he found himself, and before long he was being celebrated as a cultural hero of his time. "You've probably heard his name,"
Nutmeg said.
"But in fact, by then, I was doing 2/3 of the design work myself. His bold original ideas had taken off commercially, and he had already come up with more than enough of them to keep us going. It was my job to develop and expand them and give them form. No matter how large the company grew, we never hired other designers. Our support staff expanded, but the crucial part we did ourselves. All we wanted was to make the clothing we wanted to make, not worry about the people who would buy it. We did no market research or cost calculations or strategy planning. If we decided we wanted to make something a certain way, we designed it that way, used the best materials we could find, and took all the time we needed to make it. What other houses could do in two steps, we did in four. Where they used 3 yards of cloth, we used four. We personally inspected and passed every piece that left our shop. What didn't sell, we disposed of. We sold nothing at discount. Our prices were on the high side, of course. Industry people thought we were crazy, but our clothing became a symbol of the era, along with Peter Max, Woodstock, Twiggy, Easy Rider, and all that. We had so much fun designing clothes back then. We could do the wildest things, and our clients were right there with us. It was as if we had sprouted great big wings and could fly anywhere we liked.
Just as their business was getting into its stride, however, Nutmeg and her husband began to grow more distant. Even as they worked side by side, she would sense now and then that his heart was wandering somewhere far away. His eyes seemed to have lost that hungry gleam they once had. The violent streak that used to make him throw things now almost never surfaced. Instead, she would often find him staring off into space as if deep in thought. The two of them hardly ever talked outside the workplace, and the nights when he did not come home at all grew in number. Nutmeg sensed that he had several women in his life now, but this was not a source of pain for her. She thought of it as inevitable, because they had long since ceased having physical relations, mainly because Nutmeg had lost the desire for sex. It was late in 1975, when Nutmeg was 40 and Cinnamon 11, that her husband was killed. His body was found in an Akasaka hotel room, slashed to bits. The maid found him when she used her pass key to enter the room for cleaning at 11 in the morning. The lavatory looked as if it had been the site of a bloodbath. The body itself had been virtually drained dry, and it was missing its heart and stomach and liver and both kidneys and pancreas, as if whoever had killed him had cut those organs out and taken them somewhere in plastic bags or some such containers. The head had been severed from the torso and placed on the lid of the toilet, facing outward, the face chopped to mincemeat. The killer had apparently cut off and chopped up the head first, then set about collecting the organs. To cut the organs out of a human being must have taken some exceptionally sharp implements and considerable technical skill. Several ribs had to be cut through with a saw, a time-consuming and bloody operation. Nor was it clear why anyone would have gone to so much trouble. Taken up with the holiday rush, the clerk at the front desk recalled only that Nutmeg's husband had checked into his 12th floor room at 10 o'clock the previous night with a woman, a pretty woman, perhaps 30 years of age, wearing a red overcoat and not particularly tall. She had been carrying nothing more than a small purse. The bed showed signs of sexual activity. The hair and fluid recovered from the sheets were his pubic hair and semen. The room was full of fingerprints, but too many to be of use in the investigation. His small leather suitcase held only a change of underwear, a few toilet articles, a folder holding some work-related documents, and one magazine. More than 100,000 yen in cash and several credit cards remained in his wallet. But a notebook that he should have had was missing. There were no signs of a struggle in the room. The police investigated all his known associates, but could not come up with a woman who fit the hotel clerk's description. The few women they did find had no cause for deep-seated hatred or jealousy, and all had solid alibis. There were a good number of people who disliked him in the fashion world, not a world known for its warm, friendly atmosphere, but none who seemed to have hated him enough to kill him, and no one who would have had the technical training to cut 6 organs out of his body. The murder of a well-known fashion designer was, of course, widely reported in the press, and with some sensationalism, but the police used a number of technicalities to suppress the information about the taking of the organs in order to avoid the glare of publicity that would surround such a bizarre murder case. The prestigious hotel seems also to have exerted some pressure to keep its association with the affair to a minimum. Little more was released than the fact that he had been stabbed to death in one of their rooms. Rumors circulated for a while that there had been something abnormal involved,
but nothing more specific ever emerged. The police conducted a massive investigation, but the killer was never caught, nor was a motive established.
That hotel room is probably still sealed, said Nutmeg.
The spring of the year after her husband was killed, Nutmeg sold the company, complete with retail stores, inventory, and brand name, to a major fashion manufacturer. When the lawyer who had conducted the negotiations for her brought the contract, Nutmeg set her seal to it without a word and with hardly a glance at the sale price. Once she had let the company go, Nutmeg discovered that all traces of her passion for designing clothes had evaporated. The intense stream of desire had dried up, where once it had been the meaning of her life. She would accept an occasional assignment and carry it off with all the skill of a first-rate professional, but without a trace of joy. It was like eating food that had no taste. She felt as if they had plucked out her own innards. Those who knew her former energy and skill remembered Nutmeg as a kind of legendary presence, and requests never ceased from such people, but apart from the very few that she could not refuse, she turned them down. Following the advice of her accountant, she invested her money in stocks and property, and her wealth expanded in those years of growth. Not long after she sold the company, her mother died of heart disease. She was hosing the pavement outside the house on a hot August afternoon, when suddenly she complained she felt bad. She lay down and slept, her snoring disturbingly loud, and soon she was dead. Nutmeg and Cinnamon were left alone in the world. Nutmeg closed herself up in the house for over a year, spending each day on the sofa, looking at the garden, as if trying to find all the peace and quiet that she had missed in her life thus far. Hardly eating, she would sleep 10 hours a day. Cinnamon, who would normally have begun secondary school, took care of the house in his mother's stead, playing Mozart and Haydn sonatas between chores and studying several languages. This nearly blank, quiet space in her life had gone on for a year, when Nutmeg happened by chance to discover that she possessed a certain special power, a strange ability of which she had no previous awareness. She imagined that it might have welled up inside her to replace the intense passion for design that had evaporated, and indeed this power became her new profession, though it was not something she herself had sought out. The first beneficiary of her strange power was the wife of a department store owner, a bright, energetic woman who had been an opera singer in her youth. She had recognized Nutmeg's talent long before she became a famous designer, and she had watched over her career. Without this woman's support, Nutmeg's company might have failed in its infancy. Because of their special relationship, Nutmeg agreed to help the woman and her daughter choose and coordinate their outfits for the daughter's wedding, a task that she did not find taxing. Nutmeg and the woman were chatting as they waited for the daughter to be fitted when, without warning, the woman suddenly pressed her hands to her head and knelt down on the floor unsteadily. Nutmeg, horrified, grabbed her to keep her from falling and began stroking the woman's right temple. She did this by reflex, without thought, but no sooner had her palm started moving than she felt a certain something there, as if she were feeling an object inside a cloth bag. Confused, Nutmeg closed her eyes and tried to think about something else. What came to her then was the zoo in Xinqing, the zoo on a day when it was closed and she was there all by herself, something only she was permitted as the chief veterinary surgeon's daughter. That had been the happiest time of her life, when she was protected and loved and reassured. It was her earliest memory, the empty zoo. She thought of the smells and the brilliant light and the shape of each cloud floating in the sky. She walked alone from cage to cage. The season was autumn, the sky high and clear, and flocks of Manchurian birds were winging from tree to tree. That had been her original world, a world that in many senses had been lost forever. She did not know how much time passed during this reverie, but at last the woman raised herself to her full height and apologized to Nutmeg. She was still disoriented, but her headache seemed to have gone, she said. Some days later, Nutmeg was amazed to receive a far larger payment than she had anticipated for the job she had done. The department store owner's wife called Nutmeg about a month later, inviting her out to lunch. After they had finished eating, she suggested that they go to her home, where she said to Nutmeg,
"I wonder if you would mind putting your hand on my head the way you did before. There's something I want to check."
Nutmeg had no particular reason to refuse. She sat next to the woman and placed her palm on the woman's temple. She could feel that same something she had felt before. To get a better sense of its shape, she concentrated all her attention on it, but the shape began to twist and change.
It's alive. Nutmeg felt a twinge of fear. She closed her eyes and thought about the Xinqing Zoo. This was not hard for her. All she had to do was bring to mind the story she had told Cinnamon and the scenes she had described for him. Her consciousness left her body, wandered for a while in the spaces between memory and story, then came back. When she regained consciousness, the woman took her hand and thanked her. Nutmeg asked nothing about what had just happened, and the woman offered no explanations. As before, Nutmeg felt a mild fatigue, and a light film of sweat clung to her forehead. When she left, the woman thanked her for taking the time and trouble to visit, and tried to hand her an envelope containing money, but Nutmeg refused to take it, politely but firmly.
"This is not my job," she said, "and besides, you paid me too much last time." The woman did not insist. Some weeks later, the woman introduced Nutmeg to another woman. This one was in her mid-40s. She was small and had sharp, sunken eyes. The clothing she wore was of exceptionally high quality, but apart from a silver wedding band, she wore no accessories. It was clear from the atmosphere she projected that she was no ordinary person.
The department store owner's wife had told Nutmeg,
"She wants you to do for her the same thing you did for me. Now please don't refuse, and when she gives you money, don't say anything, just take it. In the long run, it will be an important thing for you, and for me."
Nutmeg went to an inner room with the woman and placed her palm on the woman's temple as she had done before. There was a different something inside this woman. It was stronger than the one inside the department store owner's wife, and its movements were more rapid. Nutmeg closed her eyes, held her breath, and tried to suppress the movement. She concentrated more strongly and pursued her memories with more tenacity. Burrowing into the tiniest folds she found there, she sent the warmth of her memories into the something.
"And before I knew it, that had become my work," said Nutmeg.
She realized that she had been enfolded by a great flow, and when he grew up, Cinnamon became his mother's assistant.
21. The Mystery of the Hanging House, 2.
Setagaya, Tokyo, the people of the Hanging House. Famous politician's shadow, now you see it, now you don't. Amazing, ingenious cloak of invisibility. What secret is it hiding? From the Blah Blah Weekly, November 21st. As first revealed in the October 7 issue of this magazine, there is a house in a quiet Setagaya residential neighborhood known to locals as the Hanging House. All those who ever lived there have been visited by misfortune and ended their lives in suicide, the majority by hanging. Summary of earlier article omitted. Our investigations have led us to only one solid fact, namely that there is a brick wall standing at the end of every route we have taken in attempting to learn the identity of the new owner of the Hanging House. We managed to find the construction company that built the house, but all attempts to get information from them were rejected. The dummy company through which the land was purchased is legally 100% clean and offers no opening. The whole deal was set up with such ingenious attention to detail, we can only assume there was some reason for the fact. One other thing that aroused our curiosity was the accounting firm that assisted in setting up the dummy company that bought the land. Our investigations have shown that the firm was established 5 years ago as a kind of shadow subcontractor to an accounting firm well known in political circles. The prominent accounting firm has several of these subcontractors, each designed to handle a particular kind of job and to be dropped like a lizard's tail in case of trouble. The accounting firm itself has never been investigated by the prosecutor's office, but according to a political reporter for a certain major newspaper, its name has come up in any number of political scandals, so of course the authorities have their eye on it. It's not hard to guess, then, that there is some kind of connection between the new resident of the Hanging House and some powerful politician. The high walls, the tight security using the latest electronic equipment, the leased black Mercedes, the cleverly set up dummy company. This kind of know-how suggests to us the involvement of a major political figure. Total secrecy. Our news team did a survey of the movements into and out of the Hanging House by the black Mercedes. In one 10-day period, the car made a total of 21 visits to the house, or approximately 2 visits per day. They observed a regular pattern to these visits. First, the car would show up at 9 o'clock in the morning and leave at 10:30. The driver was very punctual, with no more than 5 minutes variation from day to day. In contrast to the predictability of these morning visits, however, the others were highly irregular. Most were recorded to have occurred between 1 and 3 in the afternoon, but the times in and out varied considerably. There was also considerable variation in the length of time the car would remain parked in the compound, from under 20 minutes to a full hour. These facts have led us to the following suppositions. 1. The car's regular AM visits. These suggest that someone is commuting to this house. The identity of the commuter is unclear, however, owing to the black-tinted glass used all around the car. 2. The car's irregular PM visits. These suggest the arrival of guests and are probably tailored to the guest's convenience. Whether these guests arrive singly or with others is unclear. 3. There seems to be no activity in the house at night. It is also unclear whether or not anyone lives there. From outside the property, it is impossible to tell if any lights are being used. One more important point. The only thing to enter or leave the property during our 10-day survey was the black Mercedes. No other cars, no people on foot. Common sense tells us that something strange is going on here. The someone living in the house never goes out to shop or to go for a walk. People arrive and depart exclusively in the large Mercedes with tinted windows. In other words, for some reason, they do not want their faces seen under any circumstances. What could be the reason for this? Why must they go to so much trouble and expense in order to do what they do in total secrecy? We might add here that the front gate is the only way in and out of the property. A narrow alley runs behind the lot, but this leads nowhere. The only way into or out of this alley is through private property. According to the neighbors, none of the residents is presently using the alley, which is no doubt why the house has no gate to the back alley. The only thing there is the towering wall, like huge castle ramparts. Several times during the 10 days, the button on the intercom at the front gate was pushed by people who appeared to be newspaper canvassers or salesmen, but with no response whatever. If there was anyone inside, it is conceivable that a closed-circuit video camera was being used to screen visitors. There were no deliveries of mail or visits by any of the express services. For these reasons, the only investigative route left open to us was to tail the Mercedes and determine its destination. Following the shiny, slow-moving car through city traffic was not difficult, but we could get only as far as the entrance to the underground parking lot of a 5-star Akasaka hotel. A uniformed guard was stationed there, and the only way in was with a special pass card, so our car was unable to follow the Mercedes inside. This particular hotel is the site of numerous international conferences, which means that many VIPs stay there, as do many famous entertainers from abroad. To ensure their security and privacy, the VIP car park is separate from that for ordinary guests, and several lifts have been reserved for VIPs' exclusive use, with no external indicators of their movement. This makes it possible for these special guests to check in and out unobtrusively. The Mercedes is apparently parked in one of the VIP spaces. According to the hotel management's brief and measured response to this magazine's inquiries, these special spaces are ordinarily leased at a special rate only to uniquely qualified corporate entities after a thoroughgoing background check. but we were unable to obtain any detailed information on either the conditions of use or the users themselves. The hotel has a shopping arcade, several cafes and restaurants, 4 wedding halls, and 3 conference halls, which means that it is in use day and night by large numbers of a wide variety of people. To determine the identities of the passengers in the Mercedes would be impossible without special authority. People could alight from the car, take one of the nearby exclusive elevators, get off at any floor they liked, and blend in with the crowd. It should be clear from all this that a system for maintaining absolute secrecy is solidly in place. We can glimpse here an almost excessive use of money and political power. As can be seen from the hotel management's explanation, it is no easy matter to lease and use one of these VIP parking spaces. Central to the need for thoroughgoing background checks, no doubt, are the plans of security authorities charged with the protection of foreign dignitaries, which means that some political connections would have to be involved. Just having a lot of money would not be enough. Though it goes without saying that all of this would take quite a lot of money. Omitted here, conjectures that the property is being used by a religious organization with the backing of a powerful politician.
22. Jellyfish from all around the world. Things metamorphosed. I sit down in front of Cinnamon's computer at the appointed time and use the password to access the communications program. Then I input the numbers I've been given by Ushikawa. It will take 5 minutes for the circuits to connect. I start sipping the coffee I've prepared and concentrate on steadying my breathing. The coffee is tasteless, though, and the air I inhale has a harsh edge to it. The computer beeps, and a message appears on the screen informing me that the connection has been made and the computer is ready for two-way communication. I specify that the charge for this call is to be reversed. If I am careful to prevent a record of this transaction from being made, I should be able to keep Cinnamon from finding out that I used the computer. Though of this I am anything but confident, this is his labyrinth. I am nothing but a powerless stranger here. A far longer time goes by than I had anticipated, but eventually the message appears that the other party has accepted the charges. Beyond this screen, at the far end of the cable that creeps through Tokyo's underground darkness, may be Kumiko. She too might be sitting before a monitor with her hands on a keyboard. In reality, all I can see is my monitor, which sits there making a faint electronic squeal. I click on the box to select send mode and type the words that I have been rehearsing over and over in my brain. I have one question for you. It's not much of a question, but I need proof that it's really you out there. Here it is. The first time we went out together, long before we were married, we went to the aquarium. I want you to tell me what you were most fascinated to see there. I click on the symbol for sending the text. I want you to tell me what you were most fascinated to see there. Then I switch to receive mode. The answer comes back after a short, silent interval. It is a short answer. Jellyfish. Jellyfish from all around the world. My question and the answer to it are lined up on the upper and lower halves of the screen. I stare at them for a while. Jellyfish from all around the world. It has to be Kumiko. The real Kumiko. That very fact, though, serves only to fill me with pain. I feel as if my insides are being ripped out. Why is this the only way that the two of us can talk to each other? I have no choice now but to accept it, though. And so, I begin typing. Let me start with the good news. The cat came back this spring. All of a sudden, he was a bit emaciated, but he was healthy and unharmed. He's stayed at home ever since. I know I should have consulted you before I did this, but I gave him a new name. Mackerel. Like the fish.
We're getting along together just fine. This is good news, I guess. A delay follows. I can't tell whether it is due to the time lag inherent in this form of communication, or a silence on Kumiko's part.
I'm so happy to hear the cat is still alive. I was worried about him.
I take a sip of coffee to moisten my mouth, by now dry, then I start typing again.
Now for the bad news. Actually, apart from the fact that the cat is back, it seems that everything else is going to be bad news. First of all, I still haven't been able to solve any riddles.
I reread what I have written, then continue to type.
First riddle. Where are you now? What are you doing there? Why do you continue to stay away from me? Why don't you want to see me? Is there some reason? I mean, there are so many things that you and I have to talk about face to face. Don't you think so?
It takes her some time to reply to this. I imagine her sitting in front of the keyboard, biting her lip and thinking. Finally, the cursor begins to dart across the screen in response to the movement of her fingers.
Everything I wanted to say to you, I wrote in the letter I sent. What I most want you to understand is that in many ways, I am no longer the Kumiko you knew. People change for all sorts of reasons, and in some cases the transformation makes them go bad. That is why I don't want to see you, and that is why I don't want to come back to you.
The cursor halts and remains blinking in one place, searching for words. I keep my eyes fixed on it for 10 seconds, 20 seconds, waiting for it to form new words on the screen.
The transformation makes them go bad?
If possible, I would like you to forget about me as soon as you can. The best thing for both of us would be if you were to complete the formalities of our divorce and begin a whole new life. It doesn't matter where I am now or what I am doing. The most important thing is that, for whatever reason, you and I have already been separated into two entirely different worlds. And there is no way we can ever go back to being what we were. Please try to understand how painful it is for me to be communicating with you like this. You can't imagine how it tears me apart.
I reread Kumiko's words several times. I find in them no sign of hesitation, no suggestion that they come from anything but the deepest, most painful conviction. She has probably rehearsed them in her mind any number of times, but still I have to find a way to shake this impenetrable wall of hers, if only to make it tremble. I go back to the keyboard.
What you say is a little vague and difficult for me to grasp. You say you've gone bad, but what exactly does that mean? I just don't understand. Tomatoes go bad. Umbrellas go bad, that I can understand. Tomatoes rot and umbrellas get bent out of shape. But what does it mean to say that you have gone bad? It doesn't give me any clear image. You said in your letter that you had sex with somebody other than me, but could that make you go bad? Yes, of course it was a shock to me, but that is a little different from making a human being go bad, I would say.
A long pause follows. I begin to worry that Kumiko has disappeared somewhere. But then her letters begin to line up on the screen.
You may be right, but there is more to it than that.
Another silence follows. She's choosing her words with care, as if pulling them out of a drawer.
That is just one manifestation. Going bad is something that happens over a longer period of time. It was something decided in advance without me in a pitch-dark room by someone else. When I met and married you, it seemed to me that I had a whole new set of possibilities. I hoped that I might be able to escape through an opening somewhere, but it seems that was just an illusion. There are signs for everything, which is why I tried so hard to find our cat when he disappeared that time.
I keep staring at the message on the screen, but still no send mark appears. My own machine is still set to receive. Kumiko is thinking about what to write next.
Going bad is something that happens over a longer period of time. What is she trying to tell me?
I concentrate my attention on the screen, but all I find there is a kind of invisible wall. Once more, the letters begin to line up on the screen.
I want you to think about me this way, if you can, that I am slowly dying of an incurable disease, one that causes my face and body to disintegrate little by little. This is just a metaphor, of course. My face and body are not disintegrating, but this is something very close to the truth, and that is why I don't want to show myself to you. I know that a vague metaphor like this is not going to help you understand everything about the situation in which I find myself. I don't expect it to convince you of the truth of what I am saying. I feel terrible about this, but there is simply nothing more I can say. All you can do is accept it.
An incurable disease?
I check to be sure that I'm in the send mode and start typing.
If you say you want me to accept your metaphor, I don't mind accepting it, but there is one thing that I just cannot understand. Even supposing that you have, as you say, gone bad, and that you have an incurable disease, why of all people did you have to go to Noboru Wataya with it? Why didn't you stay here with me? Why aren't we together? Isn't that what we got married for?
Silence. I can almost feel its weight and hardness in my hands. I fold my hands on the desk and take several deep breaths. Then the answer comes.
The reason I am here, like it or not, is because this is the proper place for me. This is where I have to be. I have no right to choose otherwise. Even if I wanted to see you, I couldn't do it. Do you think I don't want to see you?
There is a blank moment in which she seems to be holding her breath. Then her fingers start to move again.
So please, don't torture me about this any longer. If there is any one thing that you can do for me, it would be to forget about my existence as quickly as possible. Take those years that we lived together and wipe them from your memory as if they never existed. That, finally, is the best thing you can do for both of us. This is what I truly believe.
To this I reply,
you say you want me to forget everything, you say you want me to leave you alone, but still at the same time, from somewhere in this world, you are begging for my help. That voice is faint and distant, but I can hear it distinctly on quiet nights. It is your voice, I'm sure of that. I can accept the fact that one Kumiko is trying hard to get away from me, and she probably has her reasons for doing so, but there is another Kumiko who is trying just as hard to get close to me. That is what I truly believe. No matter what you may say to me here, I have to believe in the Kumiko who wants my help and is trying to get close to me. No matter what you tell me, no matter how legitimate your reasons, I can never just forget about you. I can never push the years we spent together out of my mind. I can't do it because they really happened. They are part of my life, and there is no way I can just erase them. That would be the same as erasing my own self. I have to know what legitimate reason there could be for doing such a thing.
Another blank period goes by. I can feel her silence through the monitor, like heavy smoke. It creeps in through a corner of the screen and drifts across the floor. I know about these silences of Kumiko's. I've seen them, experienced them any number of times in our life together. She's holding her breath now, sitting in front of the computer screen with brows knit in total concentration. I reach out for my cup and take a sip of cold coffee. Then, with the empty cup between my hands, I hold my breath and stare at the screen the way Kumiko is doing. The two of us are linked together by the heavy bonds of silence that pass through the walls separating our two worlds. We need each other more than anything, I feel without a doubt.
I don't know.
Well, I do know. I set my coffee cup down and type as quickly as I can as if to catch the fleeting tail of time. I know this. I know that I want to find my way to where you are. You, the Kumiko who wants me to rescue her. What I do not know yet, unfortunately, is how to get there and what it is that's waiting for